Welcome, welcome, Mush fam, to another episode of Mushroom Revival Podcast. This is a podcast dedicated to bridging the gap between you, our lovely, amazing, beautiful listeners, and the wacky, fantastic world of fungi. We have two amazing guests today on our show. Amazing topic, very, very relevant in these times. A lot of people are asking and talking about it. And we have one returning guest coming back.
Mm-hmm. So everyone, please welcome William Goss and Ryan Runavar. William, you've been with us before, and you're a mycophile residing in California. You have extensive experience in the plant and mushroom world and worked for one of the largest gourmet mushroom producers in the country. You've also served as the production team leader at MycoRicks and are now committing your time to supporting Decriminalize California. And Ryan, you co-founded Monterey County Normal, or National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, in 2013 to begin turning on the country and local cities with open source draft initiatives. And in 2015, you co-founded CannabisPermits.com, winning local permits across the state, and set up Decriminalize California to make sure that the psychedelic mushroom lovers don't have to go through the same excruciating nightmare that the cannabis industry is currently facing with overregulation, sin taxing, and among all of the other struggles that it's currently going through. So thank you both for your work. Thank you both for joining us. And we are super excited to dive in and check in with how everything's going. I know this is like right in the middle of your initiative. So yeah, let's talk.
Well, I mean, we were doing pretty good. We have over 1,250 volunteers by the time the plague hit. And that basically brought just about every step that we were using to a grinding halt. We were just shy of the 25% of the number that we needed, but we were ramping up at quite a rate. And that was courtesy of all the wonderful volunteers out there. And they would do things, for example, like go to farmers markets, collect signatures. They would set up brick and mortar facilities like, you know, coffee shops, little cafes, health food stores, yoga studios, dispensaries, all of these little spots with signing locations so people could find it on this map. And then we had a series of college teams that were popping off at some of the best colleges around, led by one in UCI. And then with all the events that we would go to for signing, things like music festivals, art installations, things of that nature. And then now, you know, we're self-quarantined and it's a pandemic. So that's certainly not something we're quite anticipating. That's like the aliens attacking or the meteorite hits the side of the continent. So
yeah,
you know, it's up there.
So it's super unfortunate.
Early, yeah, we're trying to push right now for online digital signatures, and we've allied up with a couple of the other initiatives in the state that are going through the exact same problem we are, because it was the last 2 months required to get signatures that we had. So that was just horrible timing. But I mean, the scariest thing is like, you know, number of people out there that have this and the number that are going to die from it. So yeah, it's pretty wild. And a lot of our volunteers, you know, they're looking at our government's leadership on this and they're a little bit more than concerned about it. So it's intense.
So just rewinding a little bit, what is Decriminalize California? And how did y'all get into magic mushrooms?
You want to take all right? I got into magic mushrooms back in 2008 when I was going to college in Michigan, and I was growing them in my closet because I experienced it a couple of years prior to that when I was in California in Laguna Beach, and it was just an amazing experience. And then Decriminalize California came about because basically, it was December of 2018, middle of it. A small group of us came together in Monterey, and we were like, you know, it would be really nice if magic mushrooms was next, because we don't think any pharmaceutical company is going to push this yet. So this is something that just needs to be done and for free, and it needs to be able for the average person to cultivate, because the cost to cultivate magic mushrooms is extraordinarily cheap. It's like between $7 to $11 to grow a pound, and a pound has like 454 grams in it. If you were going to be going for heroic doses right off the top, you have basically 90 doses that comes down to something like 12 cents a dose. So I think that's a right that people should have, and the other people agreed with me as well. So that's pretty much how it started.
And I got into magic mushrooms about the same time, actually, in 2007. I had my first mushroom experience with some Liberty Caps in Washington State, and then had the good fortune to be recommended to take several mycology classes at UC Davis, which got me into the mycology world. And it was about a year ago that I met Ryan at an event in Oakland with Decriminalized Nature, and there was a meeting afterwards in Marin that was where I first got involved with Decriminalized California and been riding the wave ever since.
Yeah, Will was one of the earliest people we had on board, so been a great friend through this process. It's been a crazy ride, and doesn't seem like it's going to get any easier yet. So.
Ryan had a chance to, I invited him up to a talk I was giving in Humboldt State on mycoremediation, and it was a wonderful weekend with foraging and mushroom talks, and he saw me do my talk. And
that was an awesome talk you gave. That was so cool. Yeah.
Yeah, actually inspired by the ebook that Alex wrote that's available online for free. So I really appreciate that inspiration. Also, the mycoremediation intensive. I went to that Alex Coe taught up in the Northeast. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's been a really interesting ride. We've been doing a series of cultivation classes to help do fundraising for the campaign. And after leaving MycoWorks, I got full into it with Decriminalized California. So it's been a lot of networking, a lot of great opportunities to spread the message and have informed discussion around something that's very important to a lot of people.
Yeah, it's been awesome following your journey, from working on the biggest, mushroom, button mushroom farm, and then with MycoWorks and making mycomaterials, and now working with psilocybin mushrooms. It's awesome, man. You've been doing great work, and it's awesome to have you back on the show. Just a little kind of 101, or to kind of set the framework on specific language around, I just said magic mushrooms, and I've heard a lot of people say, well, like, don't call them drugs, call them entheogens, or don't call them shrooms, so do you have, like, what is your, do you have recommendations that you like to tell people, or that you specifically like to orient your language to make this initiative sound more professional? Like, what's your nomenclature?
Basically, it's a war of rhetoric. So when we started it out, the first slogan/logo we had was Decriminalize California. And we had the nice mushroom logo in the middle, but people were still confused about it. And then we asked a bunch of people, like, okay, would you prefer psychedelic mushroom? Would you prefer magic mushroom? Would you prefer psilocybin mushroom? And the first round vote came back, and the majority was for psilocybin because it sounded far more scientific and less threatening because there was no connotation with it yet. Mm-hmm. The problem was, though, a lot of our volunteers would have to spend an extraordinary amount of time trying to first pronounce psilocybin properly and then also spell it properly. It was a shit show, right? We're not gonna lie. I mean, like, it sounds good, but like, we come back to it later and we're like, all right, how about Decriminalized magic mushrooms? And everybody's like, yes, everybody knows what that is. Right. So we put that on there, and now there's like no confusion. And it's strange too, because there's like this test where you would ask people those three words, like, which one do you prefer? Like, how does psilocybin sound? And they have like no idea what you're talking about. If it's how do psychedelic mushrooms sound? Like, they kind of like will nod their head and scratch their chin, and it looks very, academic to them. And then you say magic mushrooms, and most people's faces light up and they smile. So that's why it wins at the end.
And then really not many people know the word entheogen. And then the other one that could go out would be like hallucinogenic. And that kind of detracts, I think, from the main message. I personally like the magic mushrooms because there's an element of magic outside of the scientific lens, which psilocybin is more of a pointed reduction scientist medical term. And that's not necessarily exactly what we're about.
But, I mean, technically, you know, magic mushrooms is probably the mushrooms that actually invented the magic in our society, if you look back. So for me, it makes historical sense, too. So
it's also more inclusive in terms of the fungal kingdom because, you know, there are hallucinogenic or psychedelic mushrooms you can consume that aren't using psilocybin. So
I mean, you can scare her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This kind of makes me think of like marijuana versus cannabis versus ganja and weed. You know, there's a lot of parallels.
There's something weird out there that I've heard, and we almost ran something in a strange counter to it. It's truly illegal to actually forage for mushrooms in California unless you get a specific permit for a location. Like there's a couple of parks that apparently do it, but I mean, it's kind of strange that you're not allowed to actually forage for mushrooms here legally and supposedly sell them, even though there's like a whole world of that exists in the culinary institutes. So it's strange how like these laws that actually don't exist for mushrooms in California make it kind of a weird quasi thing. So we almost ran this thing called the Wild Foraging Mushroom Act. Still kind of thinking about it in a weird way in the background, but we don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. Because one thing that people do want to know is like, for example, like, what is the safety component for people foraging for like magic mushrooms in the wild if they're just wandering around out there and there's more awareness about it? And that's where basically, you know, like education comes in across the board for these things as it is in general. Mm-hmm. So this campaign brings up a lot of weird things. So ask any crazy question you want because we're down.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like we could talk for hours about why we should be doing this, who should be doing it, and all the many different ways to do it and the outreach. So I want to know who's on your team, because I was poking around on your website and there's some familiar faces. You know, we see Alan Rockefeller. I just met Kiana, who's I don't see directly on the website, but is a volunteer. And how big is this organization right now? And like, how many different hats do you need to come together and like make this something more professional to the legal side?
Well, we have, I don't know, like a dozen lawyers. Like currently we have over, it's like probably over 1,350, like 1,350 volunteers, and we're in all 58 counties in California. And if you check out the webpage, there's actually an infographic that'll show under the volunteer section how many we have per county. So LA has about like a third of them as it is. And we focused a lot on this area because of the density of the population and the fact that like one county has basically 5.8 million registered voters. And so what ended up happening was we ended up getting so many people that our Slack team is absolutely massive as well. So we had to break it out by all the different counties. So we do plan to update that as soon as we can. And there's a lot of super cool people working on this. Alan Rockefeller's course is amazing. And he sends his stuff out there from the field, just like these cool little updates about what he's working on and stuff, helps get the message out.
Providing pictures of actual psychedelic magic mushrooms, which is not common in the media, using all sorts of different non-active species.
Yeah, that's something. They have like 10 photos in some folder, and that's the only ones they'll use. And it's like, they get them all wrong. Like, oh my God. So like, thankfully, but like,
yeah, like just the other day, this is a tangent, but I was looking up the protein content of mushrooms on Google, and they showed a picture of Amanita muscaria. Now, I wouldn't necessarily put those together.
That is too funny.
Get your protein, kids.
And your muscarine and ibotanic acid.
So did you follow a rubric from Colorado? I feel like Oakland and Colorado Denver really like launched at the same, around the same time. Were you involved in that at all? Are you involved in, is there a rubric that you can follow? Especially like, was there one from cannabis that, there were already people involved in the initiative to decriminalize cannabis? Was there a specific guideline that you could follow, like a group of people, a book, a website? You can just follow step by step. If you, and is this something that y'all are working on for other states that want to do the same thing?
That's an, there's like 20 awesome questions in there, so I'll try to hit them each. Okay, as far as the history timeline, Denver, they were the ones to first get one of these things done successfully, and they did a killer job with it. And that was in May 7th of like 2019. And they've been working on this for a couple of years, actually, technically before it, and they had to take a second shot at it. But their version was great, and it was a citizens' initiative, and they won. They just won barely by like half a point. And I had some vacation time, and I ended up going out there with my brother, and we worked on the campaign for like the last 9 days. But we weren't doing anything like high-end strategy. We were just, to us, we were like basically nerds. We were like, yeah, let's go out there and check this thing out. And before that, keep in mind, because we'd already started working on ours in California early 2018, but they've been working on theirs for like 2 years before that, basically. So they're the ones who get the first credit, and rightfully so. As far as the next one to go off was City of Oakland a couple months right after. Then the next one to go off was Santa Cruz recently. And the Oakland and Santa Cruz one, they use basically a resolution style. So that's where city council or board of supervisors will agree that they will make this the lowest level priority, and therefore you can do basically everything but sell or buy, technically, and then you're okay. And they did theirs for all entheogenic plants, excluding coca and poppy, because you know you're not going to go for cocaine or heroin. I mean, that's not an appealing thing for the public. You want to stick basically to the cool psychedelic ones you want to work with. Mm-hmm. And then Denver only did mushrooms, and their initiative also is basically like a lowest level priority, but they also have a board installed with theirs. So they get to work with the district attorney and the other local enforcement agencies to figure out how they can handle things at a local issue level. So that's super cool. And then ours is separate from all of those as far as how our language works, because we're a different state than Colorado, certainly, even at the county level out there in comparison to our county level or city. So we actually have to change the California Health and Safety Code laws, as well as a couple of other weird little nifty components in there. And then basically ours would allow for amnesty and expungement, and you get that by actually allowing for sales, because in order to actually give the amnesty and expungement, you basically need to have sales built into there. So if anyone has a psychedelic mushroom, magic mushroom, psilocybin mushroom related offense on their record, it can be taken off. So living with a felony is a horrible thing to be under, because it eliminates a lot of opportunities for your life and just keeps driving a person down. So that was the primary concern, because it's really a social justice issue reform. After that, you try to level the playing field so you allow the average person to be able to cultivate. That would, in essence, keep the sales market in check. If, for example, if you could only buy tomatoes from one store, they could jack up the price extraordinarily high. Even if it's an oligopoly where there's only 10 stores that can do it, you try to level the playing field so you have as much access so people can cultivate their own, or they can barter with it, or they can trade it out to other people. Or if they want to go a commercial route, they can sell it. But instead of it being totally insane where you create these new bureaus to handle it, like they did with the Bureau of Cannabis Control, you basically just allow it to be treated as a standard mushroom product under California Department of Food and Agriculture, because they already have all the standard operating procedures. And what they're really looking for is like contaminational outbreaks, improper substances being used during the cultivation or the manufacturing process. So you don't have to reinvent the wheel on this. This basically already exists. For example, if they had only treated cannabis as a edible, ingestible, and a commercial textile product, like, for example, hemp, basically, if you go for ruderalis, it would have made a lot more sense with the way it worked out in the state. But that's not what happened. So this is basically the antithesis to what went down with the cannabis industry's failings when it came to the last round of language. The only part that really actually worked for them was actually the amnesty and expungement part, which when you're building out language at any any local or state level, it's really tricky because each one has its own set of laws. So you have to go in there and figure out how to do it. So you make a list of everything you want to see in it, and then you actually start putting it all together. And as an open source campaign, certain people came to the table that already have large portions of their sections done in draft form for cannabis. And then we basically swapped out mushrooms for cannabis. So it was like one of the old initiatives that didn't make the cut when it was back in the 2016 era. And then we updated it to be as efficient and clean as possible, because we also had this crazy page limit of like 11 by 17 double side printed if we were going to do in-house printing and send it out ourselves, which saves us a ton of money. So crazy stuff like that was going on when we were putting it together. And there's no proper formula to follow for it, except, in my opinion, do it open source style, where you start out with a single Google Drive document, you share it with anybody that you can. You talk to the big people, you talk to middle-sized people, and you talk to little people and little organizations and huge organizations and anyone that has influence, and you try to build a proper coalition. It's tricky. It's kind of like a chicken versus the egg sort of scenario. So there's a lot of parts to it.
Do you want to speak to some of those players that contributed language or were a part of that conversation?
The people that basically contributed the language, they had sections that were done from one of the old initiative drafts, and it was great. We scrapped out some parts. For example, there was a big overtaxation in the cannabis industry where they basically started taxing facilities at cultivation, and then they would compound that tax into the manufacturing side of things. And then when you got the wholesale distribution, there wasn't any proper write-offs, so it makes it very difficult for a business to formally properly get structured. And then at the same time, when it got to the end, consumer, patient, client, however they wish to be defined, it turned out that they were getting a regular sales tax in whatever municipality they were in, be it a city or a county. And then they would also get a sin tax, which would be anywhere from like 5 to 15% on top of all those other taxes that were compounded. So that's why an eighth is like $60 in the gray market, and in the black market it's $20. And that's also why the black market does twice as much as the gray market, because there's so much more business there. So if you actually want to solve these problems, you have to basically make it as efficient as possible and clean and sensible, and get the huge critique from your community, because different people are going to bring up very interesting points that you're going to have to pay attention to. So, I mean, some states have just absurd laws. And by the way, the way it works right now, there's, I think, only about 24 states in the union that even allow for citizens' initiatives, and they're actually trying to remove them because that's one less step you have to worry about if you're a politician. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah. And
this
then, for example,
like,
we...
Go ahead.
It's nuts. And then... for example, Will's brought up a good point before. Are some of our allies that we made right off the gate that were just huge actually ended up turning out to be the Beckley Foundation, which is in the United Kingdom. So they're an absolutely massive player in the field. And then eventually we even got like side help with certain projects from other organizations. And so David Bronner's ended up becoming one of them to help us actually do a poll to figure out how we would even score on this thing if we got it on. And then, I mean, we got the math back on that right in the middle of the pandemic outbreak. So it's just like a totally absurd scenario.
Yeah.
So
I just saw one of our allies, the Chakruna Institute, posted all of the languages, all the initiatives from us, from Denver, Oakland and Santa Cruz's resolutions, and that's available, as our initiative has been for this entire process. And now you're seeing cities around the country, even the world, popping up doing similar things. One of the campaigns that we've looked to recently is Decriminalize DC, and they were in the process of running an initiative like ours, with plants as well. And they were actually someone that first pushed for the online signature collecting, which, you know, right now seems like an absolute essential component of democracy right now.
Yeah. I mean, the rate of transmission. Like, just think about it. If you're going to have, for example, with ours in California, you have to get 623,212 valid signatures, which means you're going to overshoot that. You're going to get somewhere between like 800,000 to a million just to make sure that those signatures that come back invalid because they're like not properly registered to vote, or they're just not registered to vote, or they can't remember where they're registered to vote, or their signature looks weird, so it's, or it's not completed. So you lose like a third of them. So that means like if there's 20 initiatives out there and everybody's submitting all of their initiative packets to the state, some of them have already qualified, but some of them haven't, like half or so. And if that happens, that means there's going to be a whole bunch of government employees. They're going to be handling, you know, I don't know, somewhere between like 10 to 12 million documents that have been handled by 6 to 10 people apiece. So it's pretty bad math. Like, guaranteed you're going to get infected if you handle that. So it makes sense to go to an all digital system right now. In fact, it made sense to do it 10 years ago, but we have a lot of issues with security that we still had to get figured out. So that was really the only holdout. Right now, for example, there's a system called HelloSign where you can go online and you can load up a PDF that you can send to somebody that they can sign it on their end, and it is a legally binding document. You can sell a $10 billion company that way. So it's kind of crazy that you can't use that to have your signature counted for a petition. People would still have to vote, and in a lot of states, they're probably just going to go to a mail-in ballot system, but then they still have that issue of it all coming back in. So who knows, maybe they're going to wear spacesuits and have like ultraviolet lights and stuff in the room. It'd look cool in a sci-fi movie anyway.
Something that mushroom cultures know a lot about.
Right. They had to figure it out with anthrax. So I feel like there's a system, you know, there's tons of mail, and that was a big thing of anthrax, you know, in mail. So I feel like they would have a system to kind of sterilize items of anything. But just going back, you know, I'm a little confused because I didn't know that selling was part of this decriminalize initiative, and that makes it seem like it's legal. Like, what's the difference between it being decriminalized and you can sell it versus it just being legal? Is there a difference?
Well, yeah, we tried the original route. We were just going to have it without sales, but then we got stuck when we started talking to the state about, okay, well then what's the actual mechanism of distribution? Is this donation? Is it for material goods in exchange, barter? Like, how does this work? Is it cost of services worked on it? So it became very odd when we actually had to define it. And then what ended up happening was, unfortunately, a few weeks after the Denver group decriminalized out there, and they're just like the coolest, most awesome people, unfortunately, one of their volunteers got busted by the DEA for selling magic mushrooms. And he was doing it. He was a little bit too loud in the media about it. Like, he was bragging about it to the news. Like the local weekly paper, for example. Yeah. And so, and they reversed the social media feeds from his shirt to his logo, to his company, to his brand, to him. And then, they busted him. And you got to understand, there's three levels of legality that exist out there, or tiers you have to go to get to it. So there's federal legalization. That would be like the full smash, like where you could sell it at the federal level. So if any state wanted to, because they are their own like kind of weird, almost sovereign little countries at times, they get to define whether or not they would allow it in their state and how they would allow it. Unfortunately, it's going to end up breaking out similar to what the alcohol industry looks like, where every state has its own version of how that works. Like, some states are practically dry states. Other states, they actually own the liquor stores themselves and handle that and make money off of it. So there's a whole bunch of unfortunate examples from that area as well. And then what ends up happening is he got busted because at the federal level it was illegal, and at the state level of Colorado it's technically illegal, but in the city and county he was at the local level, it's the lowest level priority.
Also, just to butt in, Colorado recently defelonized Schedule 1 and 2 drugs, if you want to call them that, and it looks like a little bit better.
Up to a certain
rate.
It's like, what is it, four?
Personal use, 4 grams or something.
4 grams. So, like, let's say the guy was growing, you know, a couple of monotubs and unfortunately had a dry pound in there. He's still in big trouble. So it's, for example, in California, California basically, and a lot of the other states certainly, were like, you know what, we're going to decriminalize cannabis either as a medical model or eventually turning it into basically a recreational model. And we're going to do that despite what the federal government thinks. So, for example, in California, we can't bank at the federal level because the banks are FDIC insured, so it makes it a nightmare to actually honestly bank as a cannabis company. And then you can't pay your federal taxes. You also can't ship it in the mail. You're not supposed to even do it in state, technically, because that's still controlled by the federal government. So there's all these restrictions that it's still not as good as it could be. With ours, we went as far as we possibly could to bring it as close to legalization as possible. When we were basically talking to the state, they're like, technically it's still decriminalized, because if you tell them it's legalized, then they're going to be pissed that there's no banking component built into it and that you still can't basically ship and you can't do all these things. And we know basically anything that hinders access to a substance, it ends up creating some form of a black market or a cartel or fuels it. Not that that even really exists so much in the mushroom community, because most people are hip to it, and you know, everybody's got a friend that works with it or grows it that we've met. And that's kind of the coolest thing about this. And by teaching all these people how to work with it and cultivate it, if they were in the situation in California where if they got in trouble because they got pulled over and they had like a pound of dried mushrooms in the trunk of their car, if this was to pass in California and they were telling, what do you intend to do with this? And like, I intend to sell it. All they're going to ask is like, do you have a California seller's permit? And if they say yes, then they're okay with that. If they don't, then all they're going to get hit with is like some back tax fine or something like that, as opposed to actually getting a felony Schedule I substance charge thrown at them, at least at the state level. If they're doing something where, if like, let's say, for example, they were shipping it out of state and, like, you know, they're sending 2-3 pounds East Coast and they get caught doing that in the mail, that's technically a federal issue and we can't do anything to technically stop them from coming in. Hopefully the DEA would just back off in that case. So it's a crazy, weird, complex system of how all these things kind of overlap into each other and how they work. But yeah, keep going.
I know the DEA has relaxed a lot on cannabis, but in the beginning, I remember back in the day with Colorado, like the DEA would raid dispensaries all the time and grow ops. And there was kind of this battle between state versus federal. In this case, could the DEA, you know, say someone was growing like 1,000 pounds a week of these magic mushrooms, and like they weren't shipping it. I don't know what they would do with all that, but like, or they, you know, sell it in California. They weren't, you know, like I can see some people with a lot of money coming in and just treating it as dollar signs. Would the DEA, could they come and shut that down?
Well, currently, right now, of course they can, but if this was to pass into law, technically they still could, but if the state was strong and you had a governor that told basically the federal government to back off, that's pretty much the case that actually helped us a lot in California. So if you have strong laws and you allow for these things and there's the sales component model, for example, if the state is getting some form of taxation from an industry, they tend to not turn those industries down or off unless they super have to. And in this case, they wouldn't. They were certainly going to need it. Some of the other states, though, unfortunately, if they are poor, they have a weak economy overall, the federal government will dangle federal funds for all sorts of things like bailouts and, you know, disaster style scenarios. So they get a little bit more fidgety about such things. So it's more difficult depending on where you're at. Currently, right now, there's many different flavors of cannabis legalization, everything from very timid medical to basically full-on legalization. The states just seem to be doing the best as far as the progress concerned to society. The thing that means the most is actually the amnesty and expungement. And if you don't have a sales model in there, you can't really get amnesty and expungement because it's still technically illegal. So that's kind of this weird like catch-22.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Totally. The bureaucracy, I mean, it kind of doesn't, honestly. The bureaucracy is insane. And I can't imagine how much education you've had to go through for yourself, just to be able to talk and reason with these people and properly make this petition. I'm also wondering, is there any way you can petition to the state for more time to get these signatures, considering the pandemic that we're facing? Has anyone tried to make this case?
Yes, actually, earlier this week, just a few days ago, we sent a letter to the governor's office, specifically for Gavin Newsom. We sent one to Alex Padilla, the Secretary of State of California, to the Honorable Xavier Becerra, Attorney General of California, and then also to Annabelle Renteria, who is the initiative coordinator for the state, asking to allow for digital petitions. If they were to allow us to do that, oddly enough, we were able to ally up with California, a Hemp Industry Act that's trying to work on setting a few things right, and then also a very brilliant man named Liddell that basically is trying to do online petitions and voting and for basically recalls if you had to do it. So there's actually a digital system that got written out with help from the state. So they've already seen this draft. It's something they could just turn on basically. And that would allow us to collect digital signatures at least. That's the best move we've had so far. And that was one of the things that got inspired from what Decriminalize Nature DC did, where they requested something similar on their end for their initiative. Mm-hmm. So by reaching out to all these other initiatives that got shut down in the middle of the biggest peak of when they're getting their signatures, right before they're supposed to submit, there's a lot of different interested parties out there that this affects, and this really is a hindrance to government, and it's also a health risk at the same time. Problem is, by the time we sent this thing, they'd already pretty much were getting ready to take an early break for the week, to go home and figure out what they're going to do. And getting any feedback from them has been basically a nightmare. So if and when they check their emails, we've also had a couple of our people reach out to them via phone and haven't had any hits yet. So literally it's insane. Like if they're going to push back tax day by 90 days and, you know, entire states are quarantining, we have a reasonable excuse why this doesn't work and why we should get this chance to try to do it as an online version. Because then we'd be done with this thing in weeks. So it's just crazy timing.
I saw that Oregon was looking to totally legalize. How promising does this look? And two, is this the goal for California in the long run? And this is just one stepping stone? And three, does that, if you were to legalize, would that okay banking and distribution via mail and totally kind of safeguard you from federal government?
No. There's a couple of things there. First off, what Oregon is doing is a therapeutic medical approach. So you can only get it from certain medical facilities, in essence, and you have to have basically a sitting guide therapist there to make sure that the person is going to do okay through the process. And sometimes there's a pre and some post sessions as well, just to acclimate them and then see how they process it afterwards. So then our model, honestly, it's closer to legalization than pretty much anything else out there. Ours actually goes further technically than what Oregon does, because we allow it for basically any for-profit, any non-profit, any not-for-profit entity can come together and do this. And it also it gives protections for people that are in the medical industry to use this as a substance, or at least have their patients using it. So unfortunately, even with ours, that's still the same problem. As close as we get to legalization as possible, because that's the thing that actually ends this the fastest. Unfortunately, you still can't bank with it. You still can't ship it in or out of state or country. If you were to ship it out of state, it would be interstate drug trafficking. If it was out of country, it would be international drug trafficking. So that's not going to change until the federal government makes a switch on this, and the federal government's going to need an example from a state. Or what they'll really do is take the bits and pieces they like from all the different states and county initiatives that worked or seem to be working, and they'll put it together. And basically what they do is their version two, they'll just basically throw a bunch of different parts together and try to make this Frankenstein work. And that's pretty much how the majority of initiatives are actually written, because, I mean, that's just the way it works. Mm-hmm. It's kind of strange how many term papers I did write.
Yeah, I'm going to add one thing right there, which before we submitted our first draft to the state, which gave us a lot of good pointers because they did their kind of conversion into their own legalese of how this policy actually looks, line by line. We recognized in our conversations around the initiative language that there would be a huge bottleneck for the licensing and the therapists, the trained professionals who would be able to administer treatment, which would more or less mirror what is currently going on in the country and the world with institutions like Johns Hopkins, where and correct me if I'm wrong, but from my understanding, it would probably start like that with a synthetic psilocybin version until there is a natural product development, with a licensed mushroom farm, which this is probably not going to happen anytime soon. So there would be the use of the synthetic psilocybin. And, one big question that we, kind of had to ask ourselves, and it was, I think, for most of us, a pretty easy thing to answer, was, the difference between a medical model versus a decriminalized model. And I just was thinking about, I wanted to mention about S-ketamine and the patenting of the ketamine molecule, different than the other version of ketamine that's out there by Johnson & Johnson. And they took something that cost like $1.50, this other psychedelic, synthetic psychedelic compound, and they patented the other version of it, making the dose cost what was about $1.50 to about $900. And then what happens is that's just the cost of the dose, and then you have to pay extra for the actual treatment. So the payment of the trained professional and whatever organization that they're a part of. So it actually looks like a treatment for that would be closer to around like $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 in that range. And when we're talking about something that grows on wood chips in the rainy season, or something you can grow for pennies per dose, this is nature.
There's also an entourage effect too, of other things in there. Like from an analog standpoint to something that's just naturally growing out of the ground or the earth, like I would like to have both options, honestly, but I would prefer to honestly have the earth-based one first.
Absolutely.
Yeah. If there are three pillars to proper decriminalization / legalization in this world, and it works like this: it's access to the substance, it's the quality and purity of the substance, and then the final one is basically the price of the substance. So you take a model in California, for example, the availability of cannabis, a lot of the counties, it's still technically banned, and a lot of the cities, it's certainly banned in. So it makes it difficult for people to get access to unless they go to the black market, which is totally fine, because honestly, I have a lot of friends in the black market. They're still cool as hell. But
this is like 75% of counties in California.
It's
where it's restricted.
Yeah, it's big. And then if you look at the quality of it, technically from the gray market standpoint, because by the way, cannabis is still also federally legal. So it's, of course, that nightmare. So what I was referring to is the gray market, not technically the white market. It's not there yet. And the gray market, basically, they do testing. And it's pretty good testing overall. It's far more tested than your actual food products that you have out there. So they're doing a good job overall. But in the black market, of course, we recently had the vape cartridge disaster where people were getting sick from vape cartridges.
Vapegate.
Right. So the quality certainly didn't work in that component. And then, of course, the final part is the price of the substance. If the price is so expensive, or you don't have the ability to cultivate it yourself at home, like for the cost of tomatoes in your backyard or less, then, it makes it unavailable to people, specifically poor people, and then they get screwed. So you need all three of those things to work in order for it to be proper. We're in our version, we're pretty much 95% there, but unfortunately, no, we still can't bank, we still can't ship with it properly or pay federal taxes. Like, it's insane.
So it seems like also from a scientific perspective, like you brought up the word entourage effect, there is very little scientific research on psilocybin, rightfully so, because of legality. But are cities like Santa Cruz, Oakland, Denver, are they, do they have the green light to basically grow and do bench trials and even up to clinical trials with psilocybin, and even use like HPLC and different scientific equipment to analyze the different compounds and see what's going on in there?
Well, actually, you can right now at the federal level through the DEA, there's a series of application forms to actually do research on Schedule 1 and Schedule 2 controlled substances. It goes to what state you then intend to try to research it in. So if your state is somewhat lenient with it, like California, they'll let you actually research it there. And then, of course, I mean, John Hopkins, they're crushing it out where they're at. So it depends on how cool your state is, but at the federal level, it is legal to actually do it. But you need to basically be a proper research institute. You're working with proportions that aren't so extreme. You're actually flipping it to the black market. Like, you're not going to do research on psilocybin and request 10 metric tons of it dropped off in like a shipping crate in your backyard. So like, if you're a legit research institute, you can do it. And yeah, so technically they can do that. If they're a legit research place, they can certainly work with it. If they're going to apply it to patients, it gets a little bit trickier. Whether you're studying it from a mycological standpoint or a human mammalian standpoint, there's a big difference. Cultivation techniques, for example, Will, who's an expert on this, I'm going to let him take this one.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that one of my mycology professors at UC Davis, a man named Dr. Mike Davis, who wrote a very great field guide, actually applied and got one of these DEA licenses. And he wasn't doing any like medical trials or anything, but he would actually be called on as an expert witness in court on trials related to psychedelic mushrooms. So essentially people who were getting busted, he would go in and identify. So they had a component of genetic sequencing and also the capacity to cultivate. So if, you know, they found some spores, which in California, as is Idaho and Georgia, where it's illegal to have spores, all of their 47 states, actually you can have spores because they don't have these active psychedelic hallucinogenic properties. But then there's also the, they were able to grow those out, but now there's researchers all across the country with at least 30 ongoing trials that usually start like very small. And they're starting to look at some of these other compounds, you know, the norbase cysteine, base cysteine, beta carbolines. I would look at a lot of research that's coming outside of the United States where laws are a little more lax, but actually a lot of researchers can apply for this kind of like medical license to study. And they're, I think, primarily using synthetic psilocybin and doing great work. Actually, I had the chance to listen to a researcher out of Alabama and their team, and talking about cocaine addiction and cessation. And we actually were looking at that permit, and it's, you know, fairly available and accessible. It's whether people want to put their careers on the line to, you know, come out and as a proponent of this. But honestly, it seems like incredible opportunity to have a personal connection. You know, this is a very vulnerable state that people get in when they're using these substances. And from my understanding, the folks that are involved in these medical trials are some of the most compassionate people and brightest people that I've come across. And within this campaign, I've had the chance to meet several people in this field.
Yeah, I can imagine. So did you hear that someone trademarked the word psilocybin?
Yeah, I'm 2 degrees of separation from that person.
Oh, wow. We would love for you guys to talk about it and just get your perspective.
And yeah, they had a huge kind of backlash in the community, from my understanding. They claimed that it was an educational patent, not to try to sell anything. But then I heard that they actually started using that on their chocolates that they sell, their kind of high-end chocolates. And what seems to be kind of the trend right now, and one thing I like to mention is, we're working on this kind of like bootstrapped campaign, citizens initiative, right? Open source. Right now there's, billions and billions of dollars that are getting exchanged hands for different startup ventures, retreat centers, folks that are pushing the kind of pharmaceutical grade synthetic psilocybin or biosynthetic products. And there's lots of different types of patents that are getting approved, trademarks. In fact, just to add on the mushroom trademarks, reishi, Ganoderma lucidum, old word, was trademarked by MycoWorks. And often this is something that companies have to do for their shareholders and for investment, whether it's the right thing to do by our morals and values, that's kind of up to the individual. And whether it can be enforced also is another question that gets into a gray area that I'm not an expert in patent or trademark law. But ultimately, we're talking about natural products. Psilocybin obviously has been created synthetically. And does that make it maybe a little more open for that kind of industrialization? It's not great. People are trying to position themselves to make a lot of money on this when that's not the intent of our campaign and really the movement that we stand behind and are pushing forward.
Absolutely.
How are you anticipating it? Because I imagine if this initiative passes, you will have a stampede of people, one, moving to California, but also in California, just gung-ho, like panning for gold, and starting all of these businesses and trying to grow as much mushrooms as possible and capitalize on this. Are there any measures in place? Or are you kind of hoping for the best? What do you think about that whole thing?
Oh my God, that's a great question. So have you ever heard the term green rushers?
Oh yeah.
Okay. The green rushers that hit the cannabis industry, they came from all different walks of life and they threw so much money at it and they overhyped so much of an industry. And I imagine there's probably going to be a lot of that goes on in the early stages of this as it happens. But I also imagine it's going to balance out. Like I imagine, for example, everybody who thinks they're going to turn on the world's greatest psychedelic mushroom cultivation facility and they're going to destroy the market, I think they're going to come to a quick realization that if a person can grow these things in their backyard for so cheaply or in a monotub in their closet, that they'll back off from the insane prices they'll try to charge. So it'll end up becoming something like an ingredient added to products. They'll end up being probably like 10 to 20 facilities that'll end up producing 90% of the psychedelic mushrooms produced. And they'll be of varying qualities and grades, certainly. But it'll balance out. And generally, if there's more of an open market, it works out a lot better at the end of the day because you have some competition that makes sense. But in this case, we also have something that mitigates the cost to the consumer, because the consumers, if they want to cultivate their own, that's what really keeps the market price in check. With cannabis, in a lot of ways, They were allowed to do some of it, but of course they weren't allowed to sell it. So of course, to produce cannabis is actually so much more expensive per dry pound of cannabis, or not completely dry, but like a pound of good quality trimmed cannabis versus, you know, a pound of dried mushrooms. The cost difference is, it's insane.
Exponential.
Yeah. So like a pound of cannabis, let's say you're a really good grower. If you're indoor boutique growing with your own light system and you got like all the nice logs and salts you're tossing at it, you know, maybe it's between $150 and $250 a pound versus a pound of dried mushrooms, which is going to be between like $7 and $11 a pound maximum. And that's mostly for loss on bins if they're not doing it right. So you can really get it down to a very small price. What'll end up happening is the large scale cultivation facilities, they'll end up releasing in a form of dried mushrooms that some people would end up trying to white label. They'll do it in the form of powderized mushroom, and then they'll also end up probably doing extraction, doing an alcohol and water pass, and then they'll have it as additives. So they'll end up treating it the way people have treated CBD as an additive to sorts of products. So they'll take like a box of tea that maybe has like 10 teas in there that you would sell at a Trader Joe's for like $10. And then by adding whatever dosage level they want, be it micro doses, standard doses, or heroic 5-gram doses, they'll then like probably triple or quadruple the price of whatever that product is. And then some people that, you know, if you're lazy and you go to a grocery store because, you know, you're busy and you have a life and you want to buy tomatoes, the thing that keeps that price in check is the fact that the average person at home can grow their tomatoes as well. If you couldn't, you'd be paying like $60 for a pound of potatoes or tomatoes or whatever it is you grow. So it's a fantastically complex situation because it's not only like a philosophical, ideological, it's an environmental one, and it's also basically an economic like problem that needs to be solved. And at the end of the day, that all ends up feeding back into whatever social justice this turns out to be. Because if only like 10 people can grow magic mushrooms in the state of California, then you have an oligopoly, and then they can run price rampant on the society and do whatever they want with it. And that is not what we are about.
Yeah,
does that
no
make
way.
Sense?
For sure. So how are you guys feeling right now? And like, what is your honest guess? It's today is March 20th. That's when we're having this podcast. How do you foresee all of this unfolding, and about like, what's the timeline looking like for this whole big project?
We basically have 1 month to finish collecting an extraordinary amount of signatures, like over 500,000 signatures. And we can't do that with an army we built of volunteers, and because everybody's stuck at home. So unless we get the digital signatures to pass, it's basically like a Hail Mary on top of a Hail Mary. Mm-hmm. Either they come back at us and they say, yeah, sure, we'll do it. Here you go. Go for it. Or they just don't respond to us, or they say no. So those are pretty much probably the three options we have. And the longer it takes to get a response from them, the harder it is for us to get the online signatures. So
they could also delay this for a very long time. You've got different states with their primaries and caucuses getting pushed back, and that would help us to some degree, but really the digital signature collecting would help us a lot. Yeah, personally feeling a little cabin fever, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Getting cooped up in these trying times, but trying to keep positive. I've been helping out with the social media, posting lots of funny memes, or I think they're funny.
I've seen some really good ones.
Keep the doom and gloom at a minimum.
Yeah. So, not great, in other words. I mean, it's like, we're in the middle of the zombie movie right now. It's like, what the hell is going on? And like, you know, you're sharpening your sticks and sharpening your knives, but you're saving the ammunition for the humans. So it's like, what the hell is going on out there? So it's absurd. That's where we're at. Well, no. Soon enough.
So you're the campaign director of Decriminalize California. If you were the director of this zombie movie, and it turned into a mushroom movie, and how do you see this movie? If you were the director of this movie, you know, how would you see the mushrooms spreading across California, but also around the country and the world?
Would it be
legal? Would you say it again?
Oh, wait. I thought you meant like the actual practical dissemination of it. I was going to go for space spore in the zombie movie because that's actually what they did in The Walking Dead when they finally asked him at the end of the series, like, so what actually spread it? And it's like, space spore. That was it.
Space spore.
But as far as spreading it across the nation, that's tough. We could battle this out for another 15 years, turning on medical and therapeutic in each one of the states and taking a slow and pragmatic approach, which many investors and donors, I'm sure, would agree would be a plan, certainly. As far as getting this done in one shot, we need just one great president to get elected and start putting some serious weight on it and get enough of a backing of the following of the general public to pull it off. And then you would, instead of just rescheduling it to like schedule 2, 3, or 4, whatever they want to go for it, you just completely deschedule it. And then at that point, it's not just the U.S. that doesn't have to deal with this. Basically, like the United Nations and any other country that we've ever put pressure on for the drug war. Like, keep in mind, my father's from Colombia, so we have quite a history of how this actually affected countries on the outside of the U.S. as well. That would basically bring the drug war to an end, and there would only be a couple of asshole holdout countries. The best model is basically that we have going right now, which inspired all of this, going all the way back even before, is basically how they decriminalized drugs in Portugal. It certainly needs tweaks and modifications, but that was one of the greatest things that a country did, and that was certainly in spite of what the U.S. wanted at the time, because they were afraid that other countries would do that, and in their mind, that would increase the drug trade.
And that was, from my understanding, in the midst of their version of an opiate epidemic. And so it was, from my understanding, again, like heroin usage was at an all-time high in that country. And so that was the motivational force. And, you know, and you can look no further than our own country here in the opiate epidemic that we have, which, you know, arguably in some ways worse, affecting veteran populations to a huge degree, and you know, couple that with the rampant depression that I'm sure that you know this pandemic crisis will make you know even worse, you know, exacerbate that problem. Decriminalization of all drugs, but in particular, magic mushrooms, you know, having breakthrough status through the FDA to treat. Depression resistant. I always
treatment resistant depression.
Treatment resistant depression. There we go. It's just kind of a no-brainer that this is the campaign that we need right now. And like Ryan said, yeah, it just takes one good president using their executive order to de-schedule.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You would basically put pressure on the head of the DEA, and the DEA would. You schedule it, and then that's it. It would just bounce right into the FDA, and then the medical professions as well could sign off on it, saying, okay, now, you know, you're not going to use your license if you decide to actually do some stuff with this that we're not cool with. Yeah. So it's wild. If you look at models of other types of decriminalization / legalization didn't work out so well, the alcohol industry, there's a lot of things that went nuts with that. And I think as going back to something that's super important, the economic impact that this is going to have, it's not going to be the same as what cannabis is, but it's gonna change the way people view the world, and we're going to think about things differently. And as far as the opioid crisis that Will's talking about, it really does affect all of us. That's certainly true. This is one of those things that might be able to help break that. And right now, it kind of feels like we're getting at that tipping point in society right now. When it comes to the fact that the biggest drug dealers in the world actually turn out to be, you know, the pharmaceutical companies at the end of the day, backed by the insurance companies.
Yeah, yeah,
it's,
absolutely.
It's a scary time, and we've got about a generation and a half to change the way these people are thinking. Otherwise, you know, we may have gone too far and won't come back. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the one thing we're never running out as far as resources is people. We're not slowing down there anytime soon. So, just saying.
Yeah, that's true. It's going to take a lot of teamwork, like you said, an army to get this to where it should be. So thank you for pioneering a lot of this stuff. we're about at our time, but is there any like final thoughts that you want to say before we ask our very last question?
I just wanted to add to that last point that I'm grateful to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Andrew Yang for even mentioning mushrooms in their, you know, circles. Yeah, so, and then of course the politicians who want to take on the pharmaceutical industry.
Definitely. Yeah. Let's hope. Okay, so this question's for both of you, and we ask it to everyone. William, you've already answered this, but you can answer it the same or different. And the question is, if magic mushrooms had the mic and could tell the whole human race 1 to 2 sentences, what would they say?
Ooh, I think my answer has changed, but I vaguely remember my last response, but I don't think it would be too different where, you know, mushrooms to me, especially the psychedelic ones, you know, they pop up, these psilocybe species pop up in human destruction, like wood chips, which is not a kind of natural wild environment necessarily. And so to me, mushrooms are asking us to listen to them and consume them intentionally and have them spread throughout our life and share it with others.
May I go now?
Yes, please.
Free magic mushrooms. That's all they'd
Love
say.
It, short and sweet.
Beautiful. Well, thank you two for coming on the show. This has been awesome. This has been, I'm so excited for the way this is going to turn out. And the mycelial roots are super strong in this one. I'm really excited to see the mushrooms get into everyone's beings on this planet. So yeah, y'all are doing great work. And where can people follow your work if people are in California? And they want to sign your ballot and maybe haven't, how do they do that now? And what are some good resources?
Absolutely. Yeah. So go to decrimca.org. You can sign as a circulator, of the petition on that HelloSign app. You can actually print out the petition to collect signatures on, if you have a 11 by 17 printer, double-sided. We're on all the social media, Facebook, Instagram, at DecrimCA. We have even have a Twitter and LinkedIn.
Dear God, yes, we do.
Got it all. You got a Zanga too?
Yep. MySpace?
No, but we should. What the hell?
We're bringing MySpace back.
You can get those underground bands on our side.
I give you a couple dozen more signatures.
No, you got to get a TikTok, too. All the kids are on TikTok. True. That's blowing up. You got to get a TikTok.
That's actually
seriously
something that you all should totally do.
Okay. You'll get a lot of fun on TikTok. Seriously.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. That's from the mushrooms. Tip from the mushrooms. Cool. That is a wrap. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And please get involved. Reach out to them if you want to start your own initiative in your own city. We need this. Everyone needs this. I think it's an amazing initiative. So let's make this happen. So thank you, everyone, for tuning in and listening. Just a couple post-production add-ons to this specific episode. Is that Decriminalize California now has a online ballot or online signature collection service on change.org/isigndigitally. And so you can read more information about that if you go there. And it is, again, change.org/isigndigitally. Just another additional comment, Mushroom Revival as an entity and any individuals representing Mushroom Revival do not support the use of psilocybin in a city or state or country that is deemed illegal. So we do not support any illegal activity from any of our listeners. If you are listening in from a country like Jamaica, for example, then that is your own will, but we do not advise or support anyone breaking any laws. So we just needed to say that, and thank you all for tuning in.
And as always, much love, and may the spores be with you.